From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Donald Trump has been the dream president of the so-called alt-right, a movement that has been quietly building up for years before November 2016. The synergy between the activist far right and a successful presidential candidate is something dangerously new, writes my guest, Shane Burley, in a new book called Fascism Today: What It Is and How to End It. In it, Burley explores not only the complex and even sometimes contradictory ideologies that comprise the alt-right, but offers some concrete historical models for a broad-based mainstream American response to rising fascism that could beat back the dangerous trend. Shane Burley is a writer and filmmaker based in Portland, Oregon. His work has appeared in Roar magazine, In These Times, Labor Notes, and Makeshift. He now joins me to discuss his book, Fascism Today. Welcome to the program, Shane.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
So the definition of what fascism is occupies a little bit of the beginning of your book, because it's not an easy question to answer. History offers us examples. We can sort of look back on history and say that was fascism. But what we're seeing today, and Americans are curious because you point out they've been Googling it in greater numbers than before. How does one define what we are seeing today as fascism? And what does that word fascism even mean in our current context?
Yeah, it's really difficult because we're talking about something that's both kind of a historical signpost for the 20th century, but we're also talking about something that exists today culturally in different social movements that don't have state power. So we're dealing with two completely different kind of playing fields. So the definition I go for in my book is that fascism is really defined by two tent poles. One is the belief in human inequality, that human beings are fundamentally not equal, either biologically or spiritually or some combination of both. And second, that essentialized identities really define us, identities that we don't choose, but sort of choose us. So whether that's race, gender, sexual orientation, gender presentation, things like that, that those are actually really defining characteristics. They're non-fluid, and they really determine a lot of what we are. Those are kind of broad, and they're kind of abstract. What that often means for the American context is that the identity is defined about things like the differences between races, the idea that races are both very defining of who we are, but also that they're in a hierarchy, they're unequal. The same thing with gender or sexual orientation or even certain kind of personality characteristics. And so a fascist movement is one that takes a lot of the implicit assumptions of hierarchical society, white supremacy, patriarchy, heteronormativity, and makes them explicit, defines this is the way it should be, and then creates a kind of revolutionary movie behind that, because what they need is to really overthrow a lot of the work that the left and progress has done over the last 300 years to be able to institute their vision of the world.
So we see a lot of individuals today that are linked with the alt-right, even if they might sometimes not want to be seen that way. Then we see so many different movements, organizations, names of organizations. You have the sort of traditional KKK type of people, the ones who fly Confederate flags, and others whose names sound, you know, archaic. Some are new, some have been around for a really long time. How do you navigate this very complex labyrinth of the alt-right? Alt-right seems to be this convenient catch-all phrase, but it obscures the dangerous nature of these organizations. So how have you made sense of who these folks are, what they want?
Right. I mean, the alt-right was intended to be a catch-all from the beginning. You know, it was centered around this publication called AlternativeRight.com. It's no longer around. It was created by Richard Spencer, who people started to know, as a way of linking up different people that he saw as essentially to the right or dissidents to the Republican Party. So these were white nationalists of different stripes, a lot of people involved in anarcho-capitalism or paleoconservatism. And today, it's really sort of a catch-all for various strands of white nationalism associated with kind of a cultural scene. So the alt-right is a lot more middle class than, say, the KKK or neo-Nazis are. They have a certain kind of rhetoric, a certain kind of aesthetic to them. But their ideas are the same. And I think that's the really important thing to point out. The alt-right is a term that we should use because it singles out a certain group of people, the way they think of themselves and the strategies they use. But this is white nationalism and fascism, black and white, period. And the only difference is that they use pseudo-academic jargon, they use social networking, they use a lot of media making and podcasting, and they've created a cultural scene and a way of recruiting that the KKK and neo-Nazis never really could.
And you mentioned, you threw out a term there very quickly that I want to just pause and ask you to define, paleoconservative. I have not heard that before.
Sure. So paleoconservatism kind of erupted in the 80s. It was a sort of dissident form of conservatism in response to neoconservatism, which really focused heavily on foreign intervention. And what paleoconservatives wanted to do was to have a more America first isolationist perspective.
I mean, is it anything to do with paleontology? Where's the paleo coming from?
They're both dinosaurs, so sort of. Basically, what they had this image of themselves that conservatism was of the 20s and 30s was kind of the pure current conservatism. It was focused on economic nationalism, traditional families, and things like that. And the direction they saw the Republican Party going was what they call compassionate conservatism, which was intervention, forcing democracy on other countries, they'd say, and social liberalism. And so paleoconservatism was a really hard right-wing response to that that linked to the GOP in some ways and also connected with the burgeoning libertarian movement. And the most well-known figure you'll know out of that is Pat Buchanan. That would be a paleoconservative. Some publications like Chronicles and the American Conservative came out of that as well. So in a lot of ways, what paleoconservatism was a semi-mainstream version of very far-right politics. And so they linked up on the one side with some members of Congress, and on the other side with open white nationalists.
So we talked a little bit about the sort of white nationalism aspect of this movement, but they are also united seemingly in their revulsion for women. This is largely male movement. Misogyny is a very overt theme, and this goes hand in hand, I suppose, with what you were saying earlier about wanting to preserve patriarchy. But we're seeing a really big, vibrant, sort of vocalization of what women face over the past year with the hashtag MeToo movement. And I'm assuming the so-called alt-righters find that quite abhorrent because you have a whole section entitled misogyny, simply misogyny, where you go into how deep this is an issue for them. So does the sort of men's rights movement fall into that whole aspect too?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. The alt-right existed before their online culture did. You know, the online culture that we so commonly associate with the alt-right today of trolling, of 4chan message boards and things like that. But when they moved into that online culture, what kind of bridged them was the men's rights movement, was the kind of trolling that we see with things like Gamergate, the harassment of female journalists, the harassment of women in general. And so that was really picked up on heavily. But before that, they still had a deeply felt hatred towards women. This was one that believed that women should be subservient to men, that women have natural gender roles as a caretaker and mother, and they should be restricted to that, that female sexuality should be considered suspect and should be controlled by men. With something like Me Too, they're especially angered by this. What they say is that men and women's sexuality is different. And so when they apply quote-unquote feminist legalisms to male sexuality, they create false rape allegations with the Me Too movement. And people like Richard Spencer are really open about this. He thinks that the Me Too movement is completely irresponsible and that it's labeling men who have done nothing wrong except for be men, quote unquote, as sexual predators. In a lot of ways, their image of patriarchy is one of sexual predatorhood. It's of controlling women. It's of deciding how women should live their lives and being able to essentially do what they want sexually with their partners.
So let's also now talk about how the response to these alt-righters, these movements that represent this rising fascism in the United States have been countered. The favorite bogeyman of the alt-right is Antifa, this sort of, very vague, hard to pin down, not formal formation that rises up in various cities to confront on the street, like we did saw in Charlottesville, some of these alt-righters. What do you make of Antifa, and is anything that they do constructively addressing these fascist movements?
I think if you listen to right wing press, you would think just about anything you dislike is Antifa. There was an article on an alt-right friendly blog that said trans kids are the result of Antifa parenting. So I don't think
Okay.
that that word means what they think it means. Antifa means militant anti-fascism. It's an organizational form, a strategy and tactic that was started years back to confront fascists having large formations in public areas and to disallow them public space. And so the organizational priorities of Antifa organizations was to simply counter their push into public space and what they called contested spaces, being mainly things where both the left and the far right might exist, like music venues or college campuses, something along those lines. And so what the right has started to do, and this is not even just the alt-right, it's even the more moderate right, is to start to vilify Antifa as someone that's interrupting Trump rallies, to basically frame them as the opposite of free speech and to kind of demonize them as basically anything criminal coming from the left. This is irresponsible and fat untrue. In the US alone, there's dozens and dozens of anti-fascist organizations that do long-term organizing work to confront the far right, both militant anti-fascist groups and Antifa style, and maybe more community organizing focused, or ones that integrate with things like labor or rural organizing. And
And do
so,
they self-identify as anti-fascist, or does it work just naturally counter-fascism?
are you talking about Antifa?
No, the other community organizations.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. The term anti-fascism means the rejection of fascism and the counter-organizing of it. Antifa is one specific type of organizing. It doesn't include all of anti-fascism, and it also doesn't really make up the caricature that's made of it by the right.
So, the aspect of your book, How to End It, we've talked about what it is, briefly talked about how Antifa is trying to end it. But what about bringing a broad-based American opposition to fascism? What can history teach us about opposing these fascist movements on a very large mainstream scale? Because we know that these are values antithetical to most Americans. Donald Trump's extreme unpopularity, especially among young people, speaks volumes about the sort of anti-fascist instincts of most Americans. How to translate that then into mass organizing or mass expressions against fascism?
Yeah, and I think what we need to look towards and what people have been looking towards is a way of integrating large amounts of the community into direct opposition to fascist movements. So I live in Portland, Oregon, and back in the springtime, there was an attack on a train where a person who had been attending many of these alt-right, quote-unquote, free speech rallies stabbed two people in an Islamophobic rage. Well, the response was that that far-right group he was associated with decided to have another public rally, even though the community was decisively against it, and over 4,000 people came out and totally overwhelmed them. After the event in Charlottesville on August 12th, shortly thereafter, there was an event in Boston where 40,000 people came out and completely overwhelmed about 100 people, including Proud Boys and other white supremacists that were trying to hold an event. So what we're seeing is that, Antifa or anti-fascism is not just for a select group of people who are willing to put themselves out there. It's actually something that can involve everybody. And what we need to see is that by integrating community organizations, integrating organizations that are specific to different sectors like labor or neighborhood groups or housing organizations, integrating them into a larger mass movement and finding a place for them to work is what builds numbers and is able to create the opposition. And I'm not just talking about electoral coalitions and things like that. I'm talking about ones that are on the ground and willing to disallow fascist space to recruit and organize.
How much work needs to be done to convince the majority of Americans that what we are seeing today is a rise of fascism? I mean, people sort of know that they don't like what they're seeing emerging, but are most Americans convinced that the alt-right is more than just a marginalized fringe movement, that with the advent of Donald Trump's presidency, their ideology has taken to the to has brought racism to the mainstream, and that if that we need to identify it as fascism, because that word is strong. That word can really galvanize people to act. But I'm not sure most Americans want to admit that we're seeing the rise of fascism.
Right. The word is strong and the word is accurate. The alt-right is a fascist movement, period, and it's seen massive growth like we haven't seen in 60 years. And so I think there's a large portion of the community, especially after things like Charlottesville, that understand what the threat of this is. And we're seeing now alt-right attacks and attacks by white nationalists happening pretty regularly. And so the growth of a violent white supremacist movement is becoming really obvious to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I think on the flip side, though, there's been a lot of poor media coverage on what the alt-right is and how it relates to Beltway conservatism or kind of middle American conservatism. And so there's been a confusion about this, and a lot of people need to have what this means clarified so that we can see it with some sort of accuracy. So I think there's a lot of work to be done about communicating with people about the lay of the land. But I do think we don't want to underestimate exactly how much people really know about what's going on, because as people are seeing this rise in their communities, as they're seeing it rise on college campuses, as they're seeing it rise in neighborhoods, they're realizing what's taking place because they're seeing the effects of it.
And also, how important is it for communities to actually, you know, not just sort of show up when the alt-righters show up to counter alt-righters on the streets, but actually organize what you write about as self-defense formations? Because we are seeing today something that does remind us of a fascist past in Europe, where state authorities comb through neighborhoods and disappear people, immigrants who might have been in the country for decades, who are pillars of the community, as well as, you know, young undocumented folks, are literally being just picked up and disappeared. How important is it for anti-fascist organizing to actually include the very practical work of protecting one another?
Oh, I think it's absolutely critical. You know, the organizing work doesn't end in a direct kind of confrontation with fascists. In fact, that really should be very secondary to the long-term work of building vibrant communities that are able to defend themselves. So when someone's being targeted by ICE for deportation, to be able to support the family, to be able to find sanctuary spaces for them, to be able to create community accountability and you know, rapid response, that's critical. To be able to create neighborhood watch programs to watch out for actual white supremacists that are terrorizing communities, which is happening at record rates. To be able to come out and defend mosques when threats are happening. These things are absolutely critical, but they're also a piece of what creates a vibrant community that can stop fascism before it kind of burgeons. I mean, one of the things that really inspires fascism is having disconnected communities where people don't have purpose and don't have a sense of bonds. And by challenging that, by building that big community, that's the largest thing people can do to defend against fascism. And when they're doing it today, they're keeping things like community defense in mind. They're things like looking at things like labor struggles and community neighborhood struggles. All those things are going to be important in the long term.
So the community defense work has a twofold benefit. You protect yourself from fascists, but you also build those very necessary bonds that we do need, that are being lost little by little today. And those communities can be stronger in the long run against both state actors and non-state actors.
Absolutely. I mean, that should be the foundation of organizing, period. It shouldn't just have the short-term or even middle-term effects in mind, but really what is it going to take to confront underlying issues in a really radical way in a really long-term sense? And that's what you do by building really strong community organizations where people know each other, where people are connected with each other, and they have a stake in each other's lives.
And then finally, you mentioned the issue of media coverage. You know, the media has a huge responsibility. And in order to help sort of galvanize the American public about the dangers of fascism, what would you like to see in mainstream media coverage of these fascist movements? You know, we do see sometimes almost sympathetic coverage where a major newspaper might profile an individual who identifies as a white supremacist.
Yeah, I think that reporters need to think about this responsibly, and then you think about what the effect is of giving open platforms to white nationalists are. There is a responsible way to cover this, and it's important to have it covered. And I'm not opposed to having really detailed reports on people, and I'm not opposed to treating these people like human beings. I'm opposed to giving them uncritical platforms that allow them to do recruitment, to tell lies that are unchallenged, and to try and argue propaganda. That's not the responsibility of journalists. The responsibility of journalists is to give critical understanding to these things. I think the other reality is to not let populist talking points about the left or about Antifa to dominate their coverage, because they are factually untrue.
Well, Shane, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with your book.
All right, thanks so much.
My guest has been Shane Burley, writer and filmmaker based in Portland, Oregon. His work has appeared in Roar magazine, In These Times, Labor Notes, and Makeshift. We've been talking about his new book, Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.